are now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. It's Tommy and I'm joined by my co-host, John Girl, who's on our ventures team. Today, we're super excited to host Simon Harmon, the founder of Chainflip. We last had Simon on back in June of 2021 and we're proud investors in Chainflip. Some of us also personally hold Flip. Simon, how's it going?
Good, man. Yourself?
Very, very good. John, what about you?
Happy to be here with Simon again. It's been a ride since we first met. It's been a long journey, but pretty excited to finally talk about Chainflip.
Yeah, sorry we're late. We finally made it.
Hey, you're here though. It works and you're here. The devs delivered, right?
The devs did deliver, indeed. Thank God.
They did something.
We're all going to make it.
Yeah, you guys aren't just a white paper. So, I mean, that is something, right?
Yeah, we come a long way.
So, Simon, for those that aren't aware of Chainflip, give us the quick download on it.
Yeah, so Chainflip is a cross-chain DEX. I think maybe the best way to think about this for those who know what ThorChain is, it's definitely in that category. You may be familiar with a bunch of other cross-chain products or DEXs of various kinds. There's a lot that have shown up in the last few years. We specifically focus on major L1 assets as a cross-chain DEX. We primarily focus on swapping between things like Bitcoin, Ethereum. We've got Solana coming. We do Polkadot and a variety of other things as well. We really think that there's been a big sort of hole in the market in terms of offering on-chain trading for, you know, the native L1 assets across these various blockchains. I think single chain assets have been fairly well supported now since Uniswap had a big up in 2020. So, you know, ERC20 tokens and stuff, that's pretty liquid, that's pretty usable. But until fairly recently, you know, things like Bitcoin have been pretty excluded from the on-chain trading space. And that's definitely where we sit. And I guess the basic way about how it actually works is we have this network, it sits out there, it's called the Chainflip Network. Woohoo, what an exciting name. It has 150 validators. They all participate in essentially what is a giant multi-sig through this thing called TSS or threshold signature schemes. We use Frost specifically. That's not an important detail really. But then that means that this network can hold a bunch of assets on a bunch of different blockchains. And then internally within our own state chain environment, we call it, it's an app chain built on Substrate. We use that to essentially do all the internal accounting. So that's where the DEX sits. That's where all the trades happen. And that's how I manage the swaps. And using this custom architecture, not having to depend on, you know, the execution rules of the typical blockchains that you see out there, like for any EVM chain, for example, gives us a lot of control and a lot of power to develop some really key features that specifically suit this use case. And so we're able to offer really low slippage trades on really large assets across many different blockchains with very different architectures and just sort of abstract all of that away for the user. Basically, what we want to do is create very cheap, very smooth, and very convenient swaps across these different assets. So that's our main focus as a protocol. But there's a big market for it, as we've seen.
So Simon, you've been hell-bent on making real decentralized swaps a reality for years. Why at like a core level do you think that this is so important? Like why does Chainflip so necessary over the next decade? Like why does this have to exist?
I just think it's obvious, right? Like if you think back over the last decade of the history of the blockchain industry, what's been the biggest market? It's been spot trading. That's the number one thing that people are doing. Even across things like stable coins, like moving between those, that's all trading. And a lot of that has been held in the hands of somewhat scrupulous actors, one might say. You could name names, FTX being a key example in recent history. But, you know, this is a major function of what our industry does with, you know, all this internet money that we've created that does a variety of different things. But yet still the vast majority of the trading between those assets, which is very important to the functioning of a lot of the systems, is still held in the hands of middlemen who may or may not have the best interests or the best practices or whatever. And it also just, there's a lot of convenience that comes with interacting within the same information space. If you can perform all of the actions that you want to achieve within the decentralized environment, that's a lot more convenient than having to move in and out between various brokers and actors. So I think for me, like this is just a very obvious action that's been talked about since the very beginning of the space, since more than one asset existed. This has been a problem that people have been working on for a long time. And until fairly recently, the technology to pull something like this off that sort of allows us to compete with the centralized exchanges on a lot of the important stuff like cost just really didn't exist. So I think I've been hellbound on it, but I think this has been a really long time coming. And I think there's still a long way to go, obviously. But I think now in 2024, we can safely say that there is huge opportunity here in the market to facilitate this sort of trade and enable a lot more programmatic interactions within the Web3 space without having to rely on centralized brokers. So yeah, I think it's just really obvious is the key thing.
And Simon, before we get into the technicals of how Chainflip works and operates, just building off your answer, do you think that people will remember? Because like FTX was hacked, huge centralized example of a major risk, right? But as time goes on, people sort of forget, they fall into what's convenient. You know, they don't really care about all these guarantees anymore. How do you think people will be convinced to stay? Is it just the continued build out of the on-chain reality and the tooling and the features and the wallets?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've seen over the years a gradual move to where obviously a lot of the spot volume in the space comes from speculative trading. I mean, we just have to be frank about that. But that's really what gets a lot of users stuck within these particular environments. You know, if there's a particular exchange that's offering assets that can't be traded anywhere else, if there's other exchanges offering, you know, great yield on stable assets or whatever, you know, these are very attractive offerings that draw a lot of people in, particularly those that are new to the space. But I think over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot more of these sort of novel opportunities appearing in the Web3 space directly, so on-chain opportunities. And that's been encouraging people to, you know, take their first steps or move outside that space to be able to access those opportunities. And so I don't necessarily think that people will forget so much as they will be enticed by the world of opportunity that exists within the blockchains themselves. But I also think that we're also seeing a much more stringent regulatory environment when it comes to the exchange business as a whole. We're seeing a lot greater barriers to entry. We're seeing much more compliance requirements being placed on users, which is very annoying for a lot of people. You know, you can argue that it's a necessary step, and to some extent, I agree with that. But on the other hand, you know, when you're operating in a high pace environment, you really want to be able to move stuff around pretty quickly. And there's a lot of barriers to entry with that. I mean, you know, I for example, I bought some USDC on Coinbase fairly recently with some Australian dollars. And I was pretty shocked to find out that I couldn't move that USDC off Coinbase for 30 days after I bought it. I had no idea that that was a thing, but this is something that people are running into more and more. As the compliance becomes more and more stringent, I feel that there is a big opportunity to help people stay on chain and sort of leverage the benefits of operating within the Web3 ecosystem without constantly having to deal with these brokers who are being forced more and more to make their lives more difficult. So yeah, I think there is going to be a fairly consistent move in the direction of on-chain trading as sort of the default method by which people interact in the space. I think there's always going to be a role for centralized brokers, of course, but I don't think people are going to so readily forget. And as things get harder to do, I think that's only going to increase over time.
Yeah, that's totally fair. Maybe Coinbase just is not like Australian, Simon. I hope that's not the case.
Very possible.
Let's pivot over to John. I know he's going to dive into Chainflip in detail on the technical side.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, before diving technicals, like decentralized access to Bitcoin, in my opinion, it's like the biggest sort of competitive advantage of Torchain, which is like the current market leader of this like cross-chain swap vertical. I'm personally surprised I haven't seen other competition until only recently, right? With like, you know, you guys have just recently came to market. There's a Torchain fork, etc. But there's really a handful of projects. Have this surprised you, Simon? Like considering Bitcoin is like the largest market cap asset by far across like all the crypto? Or was this in line with your kind of expectation?
I think it was surprising to me at first when I first started working on Chainflip. But having now actually worked with Bitcoin, I can see why it's not really been done very much before. It is an absolute dinosaur of a protocol, and there are lots of weird things you have to deal with if you want to work for it. Like, for example, all of these ordinals and, I don't know, inscription-based platforms that you see out there doing stuff on Bitcoin, that's all just centralized. There is zero, there are no comparisons you can draw between that and, say, something like Uniswap, like Unisat. It's totally centralized. You just can't do a lot of stuff that I think a lot of developers in the blockchain space have just come to accept as standard. And I think when people really look at Bitcoin in depth, it can be quite scary to consider how they might go and tackle a problem like this without, like, Chainflip is a lot of things all at once in order to work. It's its own oracle across many different chains of many different architectures. It's its own DEX. It's got its own markets and everything else. It's its own decentralized custody solution as well. Like, we've used novel cryptography to create this decentralized settlement layer that no one else has really done, with very few exceptions, and so on and so on and so on. You know, we're really having to roll a lot of sort of very new ideas all in one to get this to work the way we want it to work. And there's really no way around it without introducing some sort of custodial solution in there. You just can't make Bitcoin work like the other chains. It's not a thing. So I think there is a lot of investment and a lot of effort that has to go into developing a system which can be truly supportive of native Bitcoin. And I think that, frankly speaking, a lot of the teams just don't have the staying power to really go through with it when there's much, much easier things you can be doing with your time. When there's, you know, much fresher, newer opportunities and newer protocols where you can expand things out and create a lot of new products. Whereas, you know, you really have to bend over backwards to get Bitcoin even to be a tradable asset, let alone doing things like lending and so on. So, you know, the traditional solution to this has just been, well, just wrap it, then we'll just inherit all of the, you know, properties of whatever token standard we're wrapping it into, and that'll be compatible with all the other protocols. And that's really a lot easier than what we're trying to do here. But there's obviously downsides to that as well. I also think there's another element to this, which may make some people not like me very much, which is that Bitcoiners tend to not really care about anything else but Bitcoin. And so the idea that they're going to use decentralized exchanges to swap their Bitcoin is kind of ludicrous to me, because I think the only thing they're really swapping it for is their local currency. If, you know, I'm talking to the real hardcore guys. So from my perspective anyway, I think the market for Bitcoin swaps is perhaps a little different to what people are imagining. But yeah, there's a large number of reasons, and it doesn't surprise me at all that there haven't really been too many concerted efforts to support it in this way before.
Makes sense. Fair enough. Let's dive into Chainflip a bit. I know, like, you know, at a high level, when you look at the first glance, right, it's very similar to Torchain in the sense that it's like a standalone app chain that's like primarily for cross-chain swaps. But if you dive a bit deeper, you kind of realize that the tech stack is entirely different. I know you guys share no code base whatsoever with Torchain. So what are the top three differentiating factors in your mind between Torchain and Chainflip? I know there are many, but I'm curious if you could give us three of them, what would they be?
Well, I think one that's going to make a big difference to users straight away is probably the market structure. I mean, like, I could go back through a chronological order of things that ended up being different as we developed it. But I think starting at the market structure, which is actually one of the later things that we did, is a pretty good starting point. We developed this one-of-a-kind decentralized marketplace called JIT AMM. JIT meaning just in time, and AMM, well, I hope we all know what that is by this point. And essentially, the weird thing about doing cross-chain swaps is that everyone knows what's going to happen before it happens. And that's just a function of confirmation times. You know, you make a transaction on Ethereum, the network is going to take a little bit of time to recognize that that deposit is happening, and then longer still to confirm that there's been no reorgs and we can settle that deposit, and that now we can do the swap. That is a key problem which you can't get around. But in a traditional blockchain environment, that sounds really scary, because normally when, you know a swap is going to happen before it happens, and you have some way of manipulating the order of transactions as they're being executed, you can extract value from that user by front running them, sandwich attacking them, and a variety of other things. So in the quest to sort of deal with some of those problems, we realized that there is maybe a completely different way we can structure this market such that those concerns are now no longer on the user, and instead they fall on LPs. So what we did is we took Uniswap V3 AMM, concentrated liquidity. There's some nice features there for more passive LPs. But then we also decided to layer limit orders on top of that. This is all mathematically integrated. It's across the same curve. It's all very nice. We're very happy with it. It's very efficient. But the important thing is that really what it allows LPs to do is, in a single step, essentially bid on incoming swaps. So let's say I want to swap my Bitcoin, my one Bitcoin, for USDC, but, you know, it's going to take 20, 30 minutes for that transaction to confirm. But that's okay, because while it's confirming, actually in practice, it is right up until the last second. No one is actually quoting on my swap until the very last second. But at the very last second, all the LPs kind of go, oh, okay, there's a one Bitcoin swap coming in. I'm going to offer this price on it. LP2 offers a better price on it. LP3 offers a better price on that. And so you have this sort of algorithmic market making auction house every time there's a swap, essentially. And what the LPs are doing there is they're essentially looking at all of the liquidity sources across the market, and they're going, okay, you know, where can I source liquidity from? Is it the Binance order book? Is it Uniswap? Is it, you know, this prime broker thing that's behind closed doors that not many people know about, but is actually where a lot of liquidity comes from? You know, how can I source a price for this? So they get a price, and then they post a limit order to the Chainflip DEX, and then the swap is executed. And so the user is essentially getting the best price that anyone is willing to offer for that Bitcoin at that time, based on the inventory they have and the state of the market globally. So effectively, zero slippage trades. You're getting about as good a rate as you will get anywhere in that moment for that swap, which is really, really cool. And differs from Thorchain quite substantially, because we don't have V2 pools. We don't back it in Rune. It's all backed in, or flip, should I say. It's all backed in USDC. So if that's the standard market structure that you see across the board, everything is traded against USD. That's the most liquid market. And so it cuts out a lot of calculation and spread that would otherwise occur by moving across pairs of a volatile asset like flip or Rune. So you're just able to be way more efficient, and you're able to do it much, much faster as well.
But if I were to pause you here for a second and recap for the audience, so the way I understand this is there are some swaps incoming from the supported chains, and then there are two forms of liquidity on Chainflip. One is a UniV3 style range orders, and then the other two is straight out limit orders. And swaps consume both forms of liquidity. I actually have one question here. Why you kind of felt the need to complement range orders with limit orders? Wouldn't be sufficient to have just one of them? Why you needed to have like both of them?
Well, why not? I guess would be my counter question, right? Like, there are two types of LPs out there in the world. One is algorithmic and the other is passive, I guess you could call it. And professional firms use both types, but generally speaking, you can differentiate them pretty cleanly like that. In the case of limit orders, in Chainflip's case, they're actually maker-only limit orders, and they're also automatically filled and closed, which is very different from how range orders work. So if I place an order to buy Bitcoin for, you know, let's say 40,000 USDC, and I'm offering 10,000 liquidity for it, as soon as the 10,000 USD I have put up for that maker order is consumed, the order is closed, and that's it. The position is automatically executed, which is great for me as the LP, because I have explicitly agreed to something, and that is exactly what has happened and nothing more. I don't have to worry about closing that position. I don't have to worry about claiming any fees or anything. It's already all been done. So that's very nice for me as an algorithmic trader, because it makes my operations a lot simpler and a lot cheaper. On the other hand, range orders are useful for other types of traders as well, who maybe want a DCA through a particular price range. Maybe they're happy to accept some volatility over the time, but they do not want to actively manage that position. It's catering to different types of liquidity providers and sort of doing the best of both worlds. There is no separate order book. There is no V3 pool and then limit orders. It's all mathematically integrated. So anytime the price moves through any orders, it will consume all of the liquidity in that price tick and then continue. So it'll move through some range order, then there'll be a limit order. It'll consume that and also some range orders on that same price tick and then just keep going. So it's all fully integrated. And I guess the reason why it's there is because it appeals to a few different actors that may be interested in providing liquidity in the protocol without necessarily favoring one or the other. It sort of offers it all in one.
Gotcha. That was a really good explanation. On a broader note, what are your thoughts on passive versus active liquidity? On a related note, I mean, this doesn't have to be just about Chainflip, but in general, I know there are like arguments for both sides. Passive liquidity is often like people think it's really suitable for a long tail of assets. And it's like arguably why UniV2 kind of picked up in the early days, right? People were just providing liquidity for new assets. It was just very easy. But on the other hand, there is definitely a trend towards like more professional, like active liquidity management across DeFi. So I wonder, where do you stand? Like, do you think both will continue to exist? Do you think that there's a trend overall in one direction? Curious to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, great question. I think unquestionably active liquidity is eating the industry and will continue to do so at an accelerating pace. Even ThorChain, who ostensibly has V2 pools and passive liquidity providers, is leeching value all the time to arbitragers who are effectively, I guess, cleaning up after the jump, if that makes sense. They're sort of correcting the prices and doing that active part, that active role in sourcing external liquidity through arbitrage. We just do it ahead of time. ThorChain does it sort of as the swap continues and relies on active input as well. But there isn't a market in crypto that isn't actively managed. It's just not a thing, unless it's a really, really long tail asset with a really tiny liquidity pool and no external liquidity. Every single pool is being arbitraged. Every single pool is leeching value to active traders, be they market makers directly or arbitragers. And this has been the case since the beginning of time, essentially. This was happening in 2020 when it first kicked off, and it's very much still happening today. And I think the sooner protocols sort of lean into that, the much more value they're going to be able to return to end users. Because by having two sets of participants that you need to pay off in order for the liquidity to be there, i.e. the passive liquidity provider and the active provider who is sort of sourcing the liquidity externally. Again, that's all just fees that are costing the user more to perform the action that they're trying to execute. We've seen in the last 12 months or so, we've seen a lot more discussion about intent-based systems. Now, what does that mean? Intent-based means that instead of a user interacting with the pool and then someone cleaning it up afterwards through arbitrage to rebalance the price, instead the user says, I would like to swap this amount. And then, as I described before with the JIT AMM, in this case, you might call an intent-based system or whatever, you have parties which some people call solvers, which sort of solve a way to get the liquidity. Essentially, it's the same thing. It's an auction to provide the best price to perform the action that the user is intending to do. And then the best price wins. And that's how CalSwap works. That's how we work effectively. That's how Uniswap X is intended to work as well. Well, I don't know if you guys have read much into that, but one of the future Uniswap products is going to work in a very similar way as well. And that is relying purely on active providers. It shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that you're going to get a much better price off a large trading firm with a large inventory that has dedicated systems optimized to provide you the best price possible. It's a competitive environment. It's, you know, quite capitalistic in that sense. The best provider will win. And what do you get by interacting with those people? You get a better deal at the end of the day. And that's really what everyone wants. It's pretty self-evident that's where the volume flows. If you have Uniswap liquidity pools, one with a larger fee, one with a smaller fee, the more professional firms that are more efficient at optimizing their liquidity strategies will happily put all of their liquidity into the lower fee pool, because they're just going to be able to compete on price with the larger fee pool. So even from that example alone, you can clearly see that trend, where the pool fees have been going down precipitously across the DeFi industry for years now. And I think that's going to continue. So where do we stand? Fully on the active side. I do think there is a role for some passive liquidity provision, but I don't personally expect that, after having observed these trends in the market, I don't personally expect a lot of people to make any money by providing passive liquidity on Chainflip, to be perfectly honest.
Gotcha. This is great. You strongly stand in terms of active liquidity. I think a lot of the arguments make a lot of sense. Like, I personally see passive liquidity to remain here, personally, because I just think there's going to be millions of tokens. And so, like, we cannot expect active liquidity to support all of them. But to your point, I think, like, definitely in the major assets will, I see no future where, like, passive liquidity can compete for the major assets. So I'm going back to my original question. The top three differences, you said, we talked about the JIT AMM. We talked about USDC as being base asset. I don't know if you want to expand more on this. And I'm waiting on the third one, the third major difference.
Yeah, thanks for giving me a freebie there with the USDC. That's real nice of you. Let me think a third one. I guess this is a pretty nerdy one, but I'm gonna go for it anyway. Let's talk about the threshold signature scheme a little bit, because I think it's kind of interesting. There's many other differences I could talk about. I could talk about, you know, the way the validator auction system works and so on, but all of that is sort of a derivative of this pretty fundamental change, which is we use a scheme called Frost, and Frost is a Schnorr signature-based scheme. Probably doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but if you're around in 2021 when the Taproot upgrade went through on Bitcoin, it was kind of a thing that was talked about for a while there. Schnorr signature is essentially a cheap way to aggregate threshold signatures and other sort of multi-party computation actions. You can only do it using certain cryptographic curves, and Bitcoin didn't support it for a long time. So to even be able to do this wasn't possible until 2021 for Bitcoin swaps anyway, but it's really scalable, like crazy scalable. The idea that you could have a decentralized public network of 150 validators churning out, you know, 100 of 150 threshold signing ceremonies successfully and very reliably at a rate of like one a second is would not be something someone would believe.
For those who aren't familiar with TSS at all, like, could you kind of explain what you mean by churning in and out? Because not many people are aware of these technologies, so I kind of wanted you to give a high level first, maybe.
Yeah, sure. TSS, it just means big multisig. That's all it means. There are some subtle differences, like how the ceremonies are conducted and so on, synchronous and whatever else, but TSS is a fancy way of saying a big multisig. So you may have heard of, you know, having a 2 of 3 wallet, for example, where in order to sign a transaction, you need to have 2 of the 3 addresses or public keys on that address signed for it to be valid. TSS just means that, but bigger. So instead of it being 2 of 3, which is what you'd typically see on something like Gnosis Safe, for example, we're talking, you know, tens or hundreds of participants all at once. There's other schemes as well, like BLS. You can argue whether or not that's a part of this as well, but it just means big multisig. That's all it really is. And what's kind of cool about it, though, is that there's a lot of complex maths going on behind it. And when you have 100 participants trying to do it, it all has to be done in real time. They all have to communicate with each other directly. They have to be securely sharing information with each other in multiple rounds. And this has to be done perfectly. And if any one of those parties screws it up, the whole ceremony is aborted and it has to be retried. So doing big multisig is pretty hard. And one of the great benefits of the Frost signature scheme is that because it's a lot more efficient than what's come before, it means that we can pull off these ceremonies way more often and at a much greater speed. It takes almost no computational power. A lot of the bottlenecks that we see in testing is bandwidth. So it's actually the servers talking to each other that slows the process down rather than the computation itself, which is not normally what you see in these big parallel computing MPC TSS type arrangements. I just threw a lot of acronyms at people there, but funky cryptography stuff has been developing pretty rapidly for a while, and we're one of the major beneficiaries of it, I think, compared to Thorchain. Thorchain relies on a different TSS protocol called GG20, and that is another way of achieving the same thing. It doesn't rely on Schnorr signatures, but that also means that it's a lot slower. And by that, I mean it requires a lot more computational power. I believe there's more rounds involved, and the end result of that is it's pretty difficult to get these set up correctly because the ceremonies themselves take so long and there's a lot of moving parts, so they fail more often. And so to keep it reliable, Thorchain back in the day had to make the decision to shard the vaults, meaning that not all of the liquidity can be stored with all of the nodes all of the time. So you don't have the same level of shared economic security. I don't necessarily think that that is like a huge concern, but it does mean that there are a lot more moving parts. There's a lot more moving of funds around. So let's say you have Bitcoin stored across 20 different TSS vaults. Every time one of those vaults has to be rotated, so you have to change the members, you have to move all the money, that costs gas. And so the network spends a lot of time and a lot of energy moving stuff around within itself that doesn't really achieve anything for the user. And the advantage of just having one huge vault, which is what we've been able to do with Frost, is that, you know, we rotate once every 3 days, once. And so it's very simple in that regard. So yeah, that's another difference. And that has a bunch of follow-on effects, like how the chain flip validator auctions work and a lot of the economic security assumptions and a bunch of other things that are very detailed and not really core to the product. But, you know, these are the sort of questions you have to deal with when you build these crazy decentralized custody networks like Thorchain and Chainflip. There's a lot more going on under the hood than in almost any other project I can think of, to be honest.
It's a very admirable work. Like the scope of work, the amount of like technical depth, et cetera, it's like, it goes really deep. I personally interested to learn and learn and learn. And then I had to like kind of stop at some point as a researcher, right? I have a follow-up to this. You said that you are churning validators every 3 days or so. Does that happen across like all supported chains at once?
Yeah, all of the vault rotations are atomic. So that means that they either all go through or none of them go through. So all of the ceremonies have to be successful, before a rotation will occur, which is very simple. It also means that we're able to roll over all of the previous custody as well. So for example, on Ethereum, we have what we call the Vault contract, which is essentially like a really big smart contract wallet controlled by the validator network. And there's an aggregate key, we call it, which is sort of the shared public key of the network at the time, if you like. And that will be rotated every 3 days. So if there'll be another auction, a new set will win, there'll be a key change ceremony. And then when that's successful, the old set will hand over the, or rotate the key within the vault, and that will swap over who has control over it at that time. But that means that all of the transactions associated with that vault, all the swaps that users are doing, all the deposits that are being made to the various deposit channels, all of the open channels that may expire, there is zero interruption there, which is really nice, and means that we can do things like what ThoughtChain calls memberless transactions out of the box, which is kind of cool. For Bitcoin, we wanted to preserve that same property where we can continually control everything that came before. So we don't have to continuously sweep new inputs from old vaults into the current one. So we actually developed this brand new key rejuvenation scheme that I'm not aware of anyone else doing before, where you say you have group one and group two. So group one was the old validator set. Group two is the new validator set. In reality, almost all of the people in group two are going to be the same people that were in group one. So there might only be a handful of changes. There can be quite a lot of changes, well, and that's not going to matter. The rejuvenation protocol will handle it. But effectively, there's a secondary key sharing ceremony that will take place where you can effectively hand over control over the old wallets to the new validator set, with, again, without interruption. And you can spread those key shares across, well, however big, much bigger or however smaller the new set happens to be, which is really cool. Of course, you don't want old validators that are no longer, you know, staked to the network to be holding on to key shares still. So we do sweep those funds out progressively to make sure that, you know, no one can sort of collude and grab that at a later date. But I mean, that's kind of a really far-fetched thing to happen anyway. So yeah, long story short, this, you know, the atomic rotation concept is really cool because it gives us the ability to sort of preserve the ongoing state and the ongoing flow of all of the deposits and withdrawals and things that are happening on the network without interruption, and to be able to do it seamlessly as well between one authority set and the other, which I think has made a lot of the more hairy stuff that can go on in the background a lot simpler to deal with and a lot easier to reason through. So yeah, that's been good.
Thanks for all of this detailed explanations. I quickly realized we kind of all very detailed in the stack, but I want to switch our attention to economics of this thing a bit. Basically, I'm going to ask you your thoughts on Chainflip becoming this economically sustainable protocol. There's sort of two different camps that I've observed when it comes to the question of like how to define profitability. One camp kind of defines it as, you know, there's going to be fees generated from swaps, and then there's going to be block rewards emitted, right? And you kind of want fees to outcompete block rewards because block rewards can be seen as like a subsidy, right? And then it kind of inflates the token. And so basically one camp looks at this in detail, like how much of the revenue comes from block rewards and how much of it comes from fees. And the thought process there is that if fees are higher than block rewards, then it's sustainable. And the other camp is like the other way to look at profitability is like, don't care about the breakdown of revenue as fees versus block rewards, but just look at it as a whole and think about like, how much revenue the network is making and how much costs it's incurring. And the cost would be hardware costs and network costs. I think both are good definitions and kind of make sense in certain situations. How do you define profitability, and do you have benchmarks against like when do you expect Chainflip to become economically sustainable, how much volume it needs to do, et cetera? I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great question. I guess my thought would immediately be, well, whose profitability are we talking about here? You know, is it token holders? Is it validator operators? Is it LPs? Is it the users? Like whose profitability is it that we desire, I suppose, is a key question to ask. What would make a network sustainable, in my opinion, is, yeah, pretty firmly in the first camp. Like, does the economic reward that is being created to pay for the necessary economic security and perhaps other incentives required to make it work. You know, is that offset by sufficient value capture? I'm not even going to say fees, because I personally don't believe that fees necessarily capture value in a relevant way for holders. You know, for example, in the case of Bitcoin, the transaction fees go directly to pay miners who sink pretty much all of those fees directly into energy costs or hardware costs, which is not in any way returned to Bitcoin holders. So that's just sunken costs in my view. Like, holders do not get any benefit out of that versus something like Ethereum where, okay, there are fees to make transactions, but you know, someone has had to pay for that Ethereum and then it has been consumed like commodity, which I think is a really cool model. Obviously, then you have to consider costs on the other side as well, like the emissions required to pay the validators to secure the network, for example. So yeah, I think it's a pretty complex topic. And I again, it really depends who you ask. Like, you know, I think a lot of people for a long time were looking at, oh, well, you know, this token should be valued at this much because it has this much TVL, which is a pretty backwards way of looking at things, if you ask me, because the TVL is only there to chase some other profitable opportunity. It doesn't necessarily indicate that there is actually sustainable valuation at play there, unless it's linked to some other metric like revenue. So I think that for Chainflip, we sort of take a lot of these concepts and try and apply them in such a way where we can make sure that token holders are adequately incentivized to maintain their holdings and not just rely on the emissions. You know, emissions are one thing, but obviously inflation is also a thing. And so, you know, you can easily get into an inflation spiral where you have to continually increase the yield in order to offset a declining token price, for example. You know, we could talk about that a lot, but let's avoid it. What we do instead is we're in a pretty unique position. We have an app chain with a DEX on it, which is cool because we can buy our own token as a protocol, which not many others can do. You know, a lot of the time there's like this buy and burn thing going on, but that often involves some foundation or some entity like taking revenue from somewhere and then manually buying tokens, which relies entirely on a social contract, which I think is fine. And there's not a lot of way around it in many cases. We can kind of do better than that. And what we do is we take 10 bips or 0.1% on swaps through the network. So anytime it hits USDC, we take a 0.1% fee directly in USDC. And then that is progressively used to buy Flip within the Flip pool itself, which of course also impacts global liquidity of the Flip token. And then that Flip is removed from circulation in a similar way to how it's done in Ethereum. So we're sort of combining a lot of the concepts of value capture here that I think a lot of protocols discuss and a lot of communities discuss and sort of rolling it all into one, which I think is very exciting. But it does mean that, you know, Chainflip as a protocol is, you know, much more obviously tied in its economic sustainability to its performance on the open market in terms of its ability to convince people to spend their money swapping stuff over Chainflip. I'm a big believer in building products that people actually want to use. And I think there's no better metric by how much they want to use it, by how much they're willing to pay for it. And if the offering that we're able to give is we give a better rate on swaps than anyone else for the assets that we offer it for, or we do it faster, or it's more convenient, or whatever it may be, whatever generates that swap volume, I think is more than worthy of returning that value in turn back to the people that operate the protocol. And of course, in turn, the people who build the protocol like us, and the people who, you know, choose to hold the Flip token for a variety of other reasons, whether that's to LP or, you know, whatever else they're doing. If they hold the token, they're participating in the network. If they're maintaining its economic security just by being there, you know, obviously, I think that's worthy of directly, well, not so directly, like it's not a share of revenue per se, not directly, but it is built into this sort of monetary system that is also dealing with elastic supply and the emissions associated with validators and so on. So yeah, I think it's a pretty cool model. I don't really know of many other examples of projects doing it exactly this way, but lots of similar concepts as play as you were talking about.
I want to move into your decision to choose a USDC as a common base asset. Like all of the assets that Chainflip supports today, they're paired against USDC. That kind of prevents the liquidity fragmentation, because otherwise, like, you need a common base asset. Otherwise, you need a lot of pools across all these assets. So that kind of solves this problem. But as you mentioned, like in Torchain, this asset is Rune. It's the native asset. in Chainflip, the analogy would be the Flip token, but instead you went with USDC. Obviously, it has a lot of implications. And I'm curious on, first of all, how you arrived at that decision, what you guys kind of evaluated when choosing it, and what are like advantages and potentially disadvantages of choosing it? Because there's obviously a trade-off in the sense that you're relying on a USDC, which is Circle's like a custody asset. So I wonder like if there's any also prevention, any like plan B that Chainflip can have if Circle like chooses to censor it in the future. Do you see that as a risk?
Yeah, of course there's a risk, but there's a few things to unpack there. So maybe let's wind back to the start. You know, when designing a market structure to facilitate cross-chain swaps, you know, the question should be really simple. You know, how can we get the user the best price? The answer is, of course, liquidity. Is you obviously need liquidity in order to facilitate that. So where's that going to come from? It's going to come from LPs. In our case, we think those LPs are going to be pretty active. So what's going to be the best for them? You know, we didn't decide that USDC is clearly the market leader in on-chain liquidity for USD, and therefore the clear leader in on-chain liquidity in general. The market decided that a long time ago. So I don't think it's a very controversial decision that we've picked it as the base asset. Right. This was decided by LPs way before we were around. So I guess all we're really doing is we are catering to our audience in this case to solve a specific problem, which is provide the best pricing for our actual end users, which are the swappers. So if USDC is the preferred asset of LPs, and it makes it safer and easier to settle, and you know, they feel safer holding it than other stablecoins potentially, that seems to be what the market data suggests. That's the decision we're going with. It's really that simple. I think perhaps like by pairing it against the base, the protocol asset itself, I think that does create a number of interesting properties, which we're missing out on as a result. For one, Rune being paired against all of the other assets in order to provide liquidity to the end user as the swapper also benefits because Rune is now suddenly incredibly liquid because there's markets for everything against Rune. So that makes Rune a much more liquid asset just by default. But I also think it drastically increases the costs of that liquidity as well. Now you have to create incentives for people to hold what are quite risky positions or hedge that or offset that. And so I think that, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the ThorChain space around various ThorFi products. I'm personally not that familiar with all of them, so I'm not going to speak too much about them, but essentially there's been an ongoing debate in the ThorChain community about, you know, how do we sustain these liquidity pools, basically? How do we keep people pairing up their Bitcoins against Rune, effectively? I mean, there's been single-sided staking and all of that. But at the end of the day, I'm making an assumption here. I'll be honest, I haven't looked into this too deeply, but just intuitively, there has to be some way that is linked to the BTC Rune pool. Otherwise, it doesn't do anything. So there's someone is paying for it. I don't know who it is, but that there just will be costs associated with that because there is just inherently more risk for LPs who manage all of their positions in USD, by the way. I don't know a single professional provider who doesn't track everything they do and hedge everything they do against USD. So it's just inherently way more expensive to deal in markets that are backed in two volatile assets because you have to hedge everything. Like, for example, we ran the costs on hedging 1,200 ETH the other day with our own market making firm, which I won't get into right now, but about why we were doing that. But yeah, we calculated that the cost to hedge that would be about 900K a year using current option market pricing. So that's a hell of a lot of P&L you've got to cover in order for that position to work. So although the benefit that you get from that, of course, is that now LPs are paying to maintain a huge liquid market for Rune because that's the only way that you get it to work for swappers at the end of the day. But of course, until streaming swaps, that was also not enough to really be able to compete on the open market with the general market pricing all denominated in USD. So for a variety of reasons, I think that pairing in USD with the goal of serving the end user being the swapper, who are the one ultimately paying the fees and accruing the value to the network, I think it's the right move. But at the same time, you know, we've seen Rune be very accessible in that way. To get in and out of the asset has been much easier than it probably ever will be for Flip. And that's just a trade-off that we've accepted in the interest of the end product, I think. I guess the second part of your question there, sorry, the the censorship part. Like, okay, USDC, first of all, like, I just don't think it's going to happen. Like, USDC as a product
is... I guess the reason why I asked this, and I think this is totally irrational reaction, but I've seen reaction against Torchain because it is this like KYC-less access to Bitcoin, right? I mean, it's not a private DEX. It doesn't support any private DEXs or chains. It's fully transparent chain, just like Ethereum or blockchain or Bitcoin. But I've seen many people being uncomfortable with Torchain becoming this like KYC-less access to Bitcoin because Bitcoin is the most liquid asset out there. And even though a lot of like normal people use Torchain, it is also true that because Bitcoin is the most liquid asset, a lot of hackers kind of like to send their liquidity to Bitcoin to do whatever you're going to do after it, right? And Chainflip is going to be another like decentralized access to Bitcoin. And like I'm personally, when I think about this, is like, I can see a future where Circle can censor Chainflip. So that's why I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on this. That's the reason why I asked.
And I completely agree with you. There's nothing stopping Circle from censoring us or any other DeFi protocol right now. Like, that includes Thorchain, by the way, who also support USDC, I believe.
Correct.
There's absolutely nothing stopping Circle or USDT or any other centralized stable coin provider censoring any DeFi protocol. But it hasn't happened yet. There's been mixes and stuff, sure. But the other thing you have to consider is, who are they censoring exactly? Whose assets are they freezing? Because if they freeze us or Uniswap or anyone else who is absolutely participating in the exact same market where a lot of the same conditions exist, I'll grant you the Bitcoin example is perhaps a slightly different case. You know, whose money are they actually freezing? You know, if they froze Uniswap or Chainflip, for example, it's not Chainflip's assets that are being frozen for dealing with unscrupulous actors potentially. This is money that belongs to LPs who have nothing really to do with these transactions in any direct sense. So I think Circle would be opening themselves up to an incredible amount of liability by hindering access to assets that do not belong to any particular individual that they can name, but rather a large class of them. And I also think that we would know about this if it was going to happen long ahead of time. There is no way that Circle could get away with censoring billions of dollars in LP funds just out of the blue. Like, we would know. Circle would say, okay, our future policy is going to be this. We're not supporting these protocols anymore for these reasons. You have X amount of time. After this, we will probably, you know, stop supporting it for whatever reason. That is the only way they would be able to do it. But they won't do that either, because that would destroy their entire business model. So I think there are a variety of reasons why I think that the concern is valid at first, but on closer inspection doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. And I think that for us, we are very much the benefit of being a custom app chain is it's just an ERC-20 token. You know, it's not a big deal for the protocol in the really long term. There are changes that can be made to readily replace it with any other asset. I think if USDC goes down, the entire DeFi market goes down effectively because it props up half the entire thing. So, you know, it's not, I don't think there's any real additional systemic risk that we're taking on by using it as a base asset compared to anyone else, if that makes sense.
I mean, I can definitely see I hear your arguments for sure. They are good counters. I also don't think chances are high. I hope it doesn't happen.
Sorry, I think one more note on that is like, I think there are not a lot of people that are interested in Chainflip or Thorchain who are actually actively providing liquidity with USDC. Like, I think in reality, the people who are doing it are very professional and, you know, really it comes down to them, what they're willing to do. For end users, it really doesn't matter too much. Like, if my swaps are denominated in USD or USDT, I don't really care as long as I'm getting a good rate, right? I don't actually ever have to touch it or hold it if that's not an asset that I'm trading. The funny thing is, the vast majority of them are. If you actually look at the numbers, USDC is a big, big source of money. So like, we're also directly catering to users here. I'm not really sure what's going on here because it seems like in both communities, there seems to be a fairly vocal set of people who are concerned by USDC. And yet it seems that almost everyone is using it anyway. So I think there's a very strange dichotomy in the space here where we're not, for some reason, not accepting the usage of assets that we ourselves are using, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's true, but I just get the sense that there may be a little bit of double standards going on here as well. And I think we're just perhaps maybe a bit more willing to just look at the numbers and say, okay, this is what people are using. This is what we're going to do, rather than being too ideological about it, if that makes sense.
Yep, that makes sense. As a follow-up here, does CCTP help you guys in any way, or LPs, or market makers? Maybe it's a better word.
Not really. There is a way that we are going to use it in the future, but it's pretty back-end oriented. And frankly speaking, CCTP is really slow compared to what we do. So just based on that alone, our settlement layer is just quicker. So yeah, I don't really see a big utility for it for Chainflip users. I think the existing bridges that are out there, like Axelar as well, is also faster and better than what CCTP is able to offer. But we are going to use it in a way to settle USDC across multiple USDC pools. We are integrating Arbitrum very soon. It's just hit local net. We actually had it running on a testnet last year, but then we kind of went, ah, screw this. We're going to launch the network first and then we'll add it. Now we're adding it. And what we're going to be able to do is, rather than having a weird Ethereum USDC pool and an Arbitrum USDC pool, which is what most protocols do to solve this problem. Again, that's just introducing fragmented liquidity. So instead, we're going to let LPs use CCTP to settle on either chain and store USDC on both chains at once and treat it as a unified pool, thus deleting a lot of the...
This is interesting. Could you actually explain this one again? I kind of missed some of it. Sorry for this.
Yeah. So we're going to use CCTP to settle USDC on both chains at once. And from a back-end accounting perspective, we're going to treat it as if it's the same thing. So that means as an LP, I can deposit on Arbitrum or withdraw on Arbitrum or likewise on Ethereum, and it'll all come out of the same accounting pool. So I won't have to have separate accounts. I won't have to have separate pools. It will all be treated as one, which is great from a capital efficiency perspective. As an example of like what this looks like in practice, if you use any centralized exchange, most of the time, they'll be denominated in USDT. And then when you go to deposit or withdraw USDT, you can do that on a variety of different chains and it will settle into your USD account. You can think of it in exactly the same way. So we'll be using CCTP on the back end to sort of settle it across the two different chains from an LP perspective pretty seamlessly. But from an LP perspective, there is only one USDC when you actually enter the accounting and you place your trades and all that kind of stuff. So again, like a nice capital efficiency feature there, but a pretty back-end focused. You know, it's not really something that we're going to be screaming to the world about. It's just going to make USD swaps a little bit cheaper for everyone. And that's really the end goal.
It is quite interesting though. That's a good analogy, especially the centralized exchange experience. Something you mentioned in the beginning of this podcast is memoless transactions of Thorchain. Like historically, and still to date, Thorchain is kind of limited to, or not limited, but relies on like wallets and DEXs to explicitly support them. So users can use Thorchain swaps. Whereas I know you guys are by default going to be wallet agnostic. Could you speak a bit about why this is a, like important differentiation? And also like what you guys needed to like technically do in order to like make Chainflip wallet agnostic?
Yeah, the technical side of it's a long story, but this was actually one of the very early design goals of Chainflip. We wanted a way to recreate the original Shapeshift user experience, and something like Changely today would be the equivalent product. So, you know, I want to swap my Bitcoin to Ethereum. I know my Ethereum wallet address, so I put that in, and then the service comes up and it tells me, all right, if you just send Bitcoin to this address, we'll swap it to Ethereum and send it right to your wallet. Very convenient, very nice user experience. And I think for those that have actually had the joy of using it, it's really fun. It feels very futuristic.
I've used it, yep.
Yeah. It seems kind of spooky at first, but then you're like, this is actually pretty awesome because you don't have to screw around connecting wallets and like clicking all these pop-ups and stuff. Like you can do it on your phone. You can withdraw from any random exchange. Like it just takes a lot of the friction out. And especially today when there's a million different web wallets out there. And especially when you're dealing in a cross-chain environment where, oh God, I have to connect my Bitcoin wallet and I have to connect my Ethereum wallet. And oh, it's actually really painful. So this was like a key design goal that we wanted to figure out, like how could we actually, you know, avoid the necessity of connecting a wallet? I think these days people are pretty scared to not connect their wallet. I think I can understand that. You know, it seems to take a lot of the guesswork out of it, but I think copy pasting addresses is pretty easy personally. But what it does mean is that we are able to support incoming transactions from basically anywhere. So we generate what's called a deposit channel. This applies to both swaps and LPs. And that's essentially a record that goes onto the state chain that says, hey, my name is, well, it doesn't actually say your name, but let's pretend it does. My name's John. I would like to swap my Bitcoins to Ethereum's. And this is my Ethereum address. Please tell me where to send it. So when Extrinsic goes into the blockchain, as soon as accepted by the network, John will be able to deterministically generate where he should send his Bitcoins to. And then he can open up his Bitcoin wallet and just send it there. He doesn't need to connect it. It could be some ancient cold storage hardware wallet thing and it'll still work, like whatever the case may be. But as you mentioned, the great benefit of that is we don't need to ask anyone permission for their wallet to support Chainflip, right? Obviously, we want Chainflip to be in as many wallets as possible. That's a huge source of swap flow. It's something that we're really actively working towards, but we don't want to block that from the user. And it also makes it easier for integrators as well, because all they have to do is make a simple call on the back end to say, hey, this is the swap we want, give me an address, and then it sends back an address, and then they can just, you know, paste that into the wallet automatically. So the ThoughtChain called this memoryless transactions, because the way they work is they send an extra little bit of metadata inside the actual deposit transaction that says the information, like, hey, I want this swap and this is where to send it. But in our case, it's just a plain old transfer. There's no special metadata. There's no special, it's just a plain old transfer. It's cheap as it gets. However, there are some very complicated things going on the back end to enable that reality. I think had we known how difficult it was going to be, we may have decided to do it later, or we did it anyway. And so we have used a variety of techniques across all these different blockchain, very different blockchain architectures to achieve the same effect. You know, some people call it sub addresses. Some people call it, you know, the create to function, which we had to replace because it's not a thing anymore. Fetch contracts on Ethereum and Bitcoin. I can't remember what the terminology is, frankly, I've forgotten. But there are all very different architectures, and there's lots of edge cases as well. Like, you know, what happens if it gets sent from a smart contract wallet? What happens if, and because, like, for example, on Ethereum, the Ethereum token itself is not an ERC-20 token. And so the way that the transfers work is totally different. So we have to devise a completely different method of witnessing the different events associated with the deposit channels there and fetching the assets as well in parallel. There was because the USDT is not actually an ERC-20 token, it's almost an ERC-20 token, but not quite. We very nearly ended up in a situation where had we ever supported USDT, our auditors helped us catch, this was many months ago now, and we'd never worked with USDT before. If we had, we'd have figured this out as well. But there was a way, there was a certain method that was called out of order. And so any USDT sent to the contract would have been stuck forever. Had we tested that, we would have found that out, but we didn't support it at the time and we still don't. So it didn't really matter. But there's all sorts of funky little stuff like this that most users never, ever have to think about. But this is when you come up close and personal to these. We remember how before I said that Bitcoin was a dinosaur protocol? Yeah, this is a perfect example of like dealing with legacy addresses and things like that, like stuff that just shouldn't be there anymore, but still is. And yeah, there's Ethereum as well. It's a lot of wonky stuff going on. Then we did it for Polkadot and it was really easy because it's newer and a lot of this weirdness, because ERC-20 tokens themselves are a hack. Like Ethereum is not designed to have tokens, but then it did. Then there were some workarounds that had to be created to make that happen. And so there's some weirdness around it. So anyway, not to go too deep into the technical implementation of how the deposit channels work and how we derive the addresses and how it's all deterministic and everything else. The end result is that users can just send money to an address and it then will be swapped. We do have to reuse those addresses for gas efficiency reasons and also the rotations as well. So one address belongs to a certain vault. In the case of Bitcoin. And so as new vaults are created and rotated across, those old addresses are going to old vaults and you don't really want that. So we expire the deposit channels after all. We stop looking for incoming swaps or deposits. So that's one downside, I would say, that, you know, if your transaction gets stuck in the mempool for longer than 24 hours, you might never see those coins again. I mean, that's pretty rare these days, but it has happened before. So yeah, it's complicated. For what it's worth, though, the same thing would apply to ThoughtChain. Like as soon as a vault is rotated and the validator no longer controls that address, if you send money there later, that's it, it's over. So it's a very similar profile.
I know it actually happened in one of the Twitter spaces. Somebody was just unfortunate thing, but it happened to someone. The community spent like kind of 15 minutes to explain why that's the case to that person. It was like, it was unfortunate to listen to. But yeah, when you try to build things like in a completely decentralized way, you will always have these, right? I think one of the, I guess, biggest advantages of Thorchain and Chainflip is that they are app-specific chains. And then as like hiccups come and like these, you know, if there's any problems that you didn't realize in the beginning, but the community realized after, you can always do like hard forks, right? Or software upgrades, basically. And then that, I think, is like a very fundamental advantage of these kind of projects, as opposed to a decentralized exchange as a smart contract, which is like pretty robust and that you can't really change all that much. And when you're dealing with such a complex project of like cross-chain swaps, it just affirms my like app chain thesis. I'm just an app chain fan. I think it just makes a lot of things very easy in terms of like governance, in terms of MEV and value capture, etc. But if you have also like some thoughts on it, I'd be happy to listen to it.
Oh yeah, a massively underrated. I think the idea that everyone's going to build everything on rollups is absolutely crazy. Like, that's not a thing. The scope of things that can and will be built on rollups probably already exists. It's not that interesting. App chains are really where a lot of the new innovation is going to take place and is already taking place. I think, like, for it to play into your example, actually, like, DYDX is now on its fourth app chain, I think, or the fourth version of its app chain, and it keeps getting better, keeps getting more competitive. So although, what do you even call it? Like, a generalized blockchain deployed application. It's a long, long way of saying a smart contract, but that's what it is. As robust as that might be in the sense that it can't be changed, that also makes it very stagnant and very uncompetitive. And you end up with these really annoying situations where for example, Uniswap, right? Like, there was V1 Uniswap, and then everyone had to migrate their liquidity across to V2 Uniswap. And then everyone had to do it all over again when V3 came along. And there were all these duplicate pools, and it was really inefficient and pretty stupid because everyone ended up moving anyway. So yeah, I think the app chain thing goes beyond just, obviously there's a lot of benefits to like being able to, in our case, like make sure the transaction ordering is such that MEV is impossible. Like, all you have to do is go, all right, well, you can do whatever liquidity updates you want, but the swaps are being executed at the end of the block. So now, no matter what, the only way a validator is going to produce a valid block is if they follow that rule. And if they don't do that, it's not a valid block. And that means MEV is now no longer possible. You can't front end run anyone. You can't do a sandwich attack because they all rely on bribing validators to order transactions in a certain way, or every single one. People will claim that there are different ways of doing it. I've thought about it a lot. I've written about it a lot. It's not true. That's all it is. There may be some cross-chain arbitrage things, opportunity that also rely on reordering transactions, but I'm sorry, that's just, it's really that simple. And you can just delete all of that with an app chain. Very, very quickly. So it's very exciting. And I think people are slowly starting to clock onto this idea. And I hope that teams are going to make a much more concerted effort to invest in app chain development. It is a huge task. It is very expensive. It requires a lot of expertise and a lot of reasoning. It took us 3.5 years to do this. I'm sure there are other products that could be done in a much faster amount of time and still achieve very high degrees of innovation. And the real benefit of it is, once you're done, you don't have to be. You can continue expanding on it. You don't have to care about the underlying execution layer or any particular upgrades that the L1 that you're working on may or may not be doing. If you use something like Cosmos or Substrate, you can inherit a lot of upgrades that those teams are doing to constantly improve the underlying framework that you're using, which will save you a lot of time and a lot of work to achieve similar effects. So you can focus on, you know, customizing the application that you're actually working on to serve the user, to generate more fees, to attract more people to your product and so on. So I think there's still maybe quite a ways to go in developing, you know, marketplaces on app chains that will end up replacing the existing single chain products. But God, I sound like a Polkadot or a Cosmos Maxi right now. I don't know what's become of me, but I just think like in the long run, like they are just better. They will just do it better than you ever could on a single chain environment. And so I think it may take a long time, but I think it's going to happen for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I Almost like 100% I agree, but one minor thing that I kind of wanted to clarify is that when I say app chain thesis, I'm a fan of app chain thesis. I also include roll apps, like app-specific roll-ups, but a different kind of them, like sovereign ones that actually don't require a sentiment layer, but that's another story. I kind of want to pass the mic to Tommy. I know he has some questions.
Yeah, hell of a combo listening to you guys. You guys are ridiculously smart. Learned a ton. Simon, I have a couple questions on a different line of questioning for you. I mean, like the AI craze is like in full effect and everybody's talking about, you know, we'll eventually get to a point where we have real AI transacting in crypto, like acting on its own behalf and in some sort of an end state. I think it makes a lot more sense for them to be using trustless DEXs and swaps versus ever having like a Chase bank account or even a Coinbase account. Do you think that Chainflip will be like a beneficiary of that movement?
I have an answer. I feel like it's going to make a lot of people really not like me. So I feel like because AI is in full craze, I should keep my mouth shut. But I can say it if you want anyway.
I want it. Yeah, give it to me.
There is no way an AI trader is going to outperform anything. It's just not going to happen. It has never happened before. They are not smarter than us. They repeat what we do. That's it. They do what we tell them. And we're not very smart ourselves. So I don't see it. I think every prop trading firm under the sun that has tried to outperform the market is lost. And to suggest that an AI is somehow going to do it better, I think is quite funny. And it's because there are already robots doing a lot of trading much more profitably than anything else. And they don't use AI. They just use maths. Called quantitative trading. It's been happening for 40 years. This is already a thing. And yeah, that's all I'll say on that.
All right. Now, I mean, the right people will like you, right? But I'll definitely think that over. And I mean, one last question, because John asked incredible questions, but one last one. Your like main job and the thing that I think that keeps you up at night the most is thinking through ways for Chainflip to be hacked, right? And you know, John, and you already spoke kind of at length about USDC, but I'm kind of curious, like what you want to share and what you don't want to share. But I don't know. I'm kind of wondering, like, if you had to put yourself in the like position of a nation state or in the position of, you know, black hat hacker or something like that, who wanted to attack Chainflip, I'm curious how they would go about doing it, or if they'd even be remotely successful. Because in the end state of true decentralized swaps, you guys become ridiculously important and. Obviously, hacking that would be terrible.
Yeah, hacking it would be bad. It's a little different to other types of networks. Same as ThoughtChain, we have a big honeypot of liquid assets that if you can somehow get them out of the network, they're still going to hold their value. So there is an increased risk profile there. I think a lot of bridges are much better at storing way too much money than they actually need. I think we're going to be a bit more efficient than that. You know, we've only got like. I think it's like 300K in deployed liquidity, and yet we're already like the market leader in Bitcoin and Ethereum swaps for swaps under the current swap limits of 25K. So it's like we don't really need millions in TVL to be a very, very competitive protocol. And I think that's going to help sort of reduce the surface area, the incentive to attack it. At least monetarily, like for monetary reasons, if that makes sense. But if I was a hacker looking at Chainflip, you know, I would not be bothering trying to get validators to collude, to steal the money or some other crazy harebrained scheme that would involve like 60 other people. I would instead just, you know, look through the code and see if there is some way I can trick the system into giving me money that I probably shouldn't have, which is basically the same way that every other bridge hack, and I think a lot of the ThoughtChain ones as well, were a similar thing, right? Is there some loophole I can exploit to make the system give me money when, you know, we shouldn't expect it to? There might be, you know, sometimes in protocols there's like crazy stuff like overflow bugs and programming, like very, very like low level stuff that some people miss, and you can manipulate and create these weird set of actions to make it do stuff that it shouldn't. Other times it's just very simple software bugs, like there was an oversight in the programming and someone fucked up basically. Sorry, excuse my French, but that's what it is. And you can just fully exploit it. So, you know, I think as much as we can talk all day about economic security and so on, you know, most protocols, especially like after the wave of the 2020, 2021 bridges and all the bridge hacks that came, that was just, in my view, that was a series of pretty shitty programmers with very poor management rushing out a bunch of products. And I think it's been long enough now that I can get away with saying that. And I pray to God that the same thing doesn't happen to us. Like, you can't guarantee anything, but, you know, I feel pretty confident that we've set up some pretty good processes in place to make sure that things like that don't get out, to the point where we recently had an audit with a very reputable firm called Zelic, who came back to us at the end of the audit and said, well, that was really frustrating, but in a good way, because we didn't really find anything. The one thing they did find was something we told them about. So yeah, I feel pretty confident that those smaller things are not going to happen with us so much as they have with other protocols in the past, because we had the benefit of taking our time a bit. We developed testnets and ran them for well over 2 years, but before deploying a single line of code to any mainnet. So we've gone through, we've caught a lot of the edge cases. We've been through multiple code audits. We've, you know, tried to not go slow by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, at the same time, be very careful about how we do our work and make sure that it's done well, and have lots of checks and balances in place to make sure that code that gets released has been thoroughly checked by a range of different people. And that is, we have a huge automated testing suite, which we spent a really long time developing. Whenever we commit code to main now, it gets a new network will get spun up. And then there is a suite of tools that will basically test every function in the protocol and do some really wonky stuff to it as well to try and break it. And that has caught so much stuff. Like, all the small stuff has gone caught by this. Every time we add new functionality, we add more to that test suite as well. And that just takes all of the, like, it makes it pretty easy to catch a lot of this stuff, because we don't really have to spend any time on it. We just click commit in GitHub, and then something runs in AWS and whoop-de-doo. We've done a bunch of testing, obviously. You can't just do that, but that is a hell of a lot of coverage. And I think, in my estimation, I don't know this for sure, but I think it's a hell of a lot more than what many, many other teams have done, judging by the frankly somewhat comical errors that we've seen enter very expensive code spaces, which have then ended up costing people a lot of money. Now, I know that's a ballsy thing to say. That is a hell of a ballsy thing to say for a project founder to come out and say, I think we're really secure and nothing's ever going to happen to us because we have good processes and stuff. So I do want to qualify my statement by saying that there is no software company on earth that can guarantee that, you know, bad things won't happen. You can have as many processes as you want. You can go through as many audits as you want. You can have the best automated testing suite on planet Earth. At the end of the day, there is no silver bullet. And so, you know, if I hope my words won't come back to bite me, which is why I'm saying all these things. But, you know, we really try, and I'd be really surprised if it happened. But we obviously also have a range of protocols and things in place to catch things when and if they do happen. We have a 24-hour internal watch duty system, so there's always a human looking at the protocol as well. We hand over everything that we monitor, everything that we see, over to the next guy who comes on shift or girl. And, you know, so we have, you know, these human systems in place as well, so that if anything does happen, you know, we're right there ready to respond to it as well, and so on. So yeah, it's a very complex topic. And I think it gets a lot into things like company culture and stuff like that as well. But we do spend a lot of time on it.
No, I'm glad you guys spend so much time on it. It's actually kind of ironic, right? Because a lot of, like, big projects that have had hacks are sort of, you know, better off because they were able to sort of cement the community, like, battle test the code base in real time. Like, of course, a hack is horrible, especially if, like, funds are lost. But I don't know. I mean, there are projects that were hacked that were faced issues that were, I think, better off afterward.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's largely a function of, you know, it's kind of like getting a slap in the face. Like, okay, you have to take this seriously. Like, and I, frankly, I've been quite surprised at how accepting crypto users have become of these things. You know, it's just take a 70% hit on the chin and just keep going. You know, it's quite amazing, really. It's really cool to see that, you know, the adopters of this technology are willing to, you know, accept the loss but still see the merit in the project, whatever it might be, anyway, and continue supporting it. So that's another really cool thing. But I don't think that's an excuse to just let it rip, basically.
Yeah. And Simon, last question for you. After Chainflip grows into an even bigger community, and you have more free time, is there anything that you would build next? Like anything on the docket that you want, you know, go out there and do?
Well, I think as Chainflip gets bigger, it's going to be harder and harder for me to think about that. But I have a couple of loose dreams for a distant me several years from now. But, you know, I always want to be a founder. I always want to run businesses. I've gotten a lot of value out of doing it. I've been doing it for nearly 7 years now. And yeah, I've learned a lot of lessons, and they're lessons I want to carry forward into other businesses. I think the next one that I'm involved in, I would like to do something a bit more physical. I've been staring at computer screens now for, you know, basically since I was 10. And I think it might be time to maybe do something where there's a bit less of that involved in the future when I'm a bit older. But I'm still 27. So, you know, my eyeballs have got a little ways to go before they're completely ruined yet. So we'll see.
And you'll be running around with a VR mask on. And
That's got to be real good for the eyeballs.
Yeah. And Simon, last question, I promise. We'll save, you know, the rest for another pod. But between like our last podcast and this one, I mean, clearly a ton of growth has happened. You know, you guys delivered, you built Chainflip, right? Swapping is live. What do you think was the biggest learnings for you as a founder? You know, if you were an advisor to a project and, you know, they came to you and they said, hey, look, Simon, you know, we'd love to ask you what was the hardest things. Like, what do you think? What would be your advice to those founders?
I think like, so I've made quite a few founder friends over the years, and a lot of them weren't founders when I met them and then became founders. And they often come to me and ask me for advice. And I also ask people for advice all the time as well. But, you know, so I do get asked this quite a lot. And I think one of the things that catches people off guard a lot is just the sheer volume of problems that come and just how to keep your head above water. You know, I did some time in the military, and I think that really helped me sort of like work out how to deal with stuff before it happens. You know, a lot of military planning is basically just like, you know, we're gonna give everyone an amazing base level of training so they can just kind of figure stuff out themselves on the fly. But at the same time, we're also gonna try and plan for every single scenario we can think of. Obviously, that's a life or death situation. In business, you can't do that. But I think that's really helped me sort of just stay cool, calm, and collected and be able to juggle a lot of different problems all at once. And sort of all like there are some days where, you know, I'm in the office and I don't really have that much to do per se. I'm not actually writing anything, or I don't have that many meetings booked, and everyone's busy and everyone's working. And I kind of sit there and I go, shit, what should I be doing with my day? But, you know, very quickly, I end up just thinking about future possibilities and you know, different things that could come our way, and sort of trying to already imagine how we might deal with certain scenarios or how we might exploit a particular opportunity. And so I think for founders, that's actually a pretty good piece of advice I could give, which is if you're not in a position where you can really start thinking and planning for scenarios that may or may not be coming up, you're really doing your company a disservice and your team a disservice, because they're all busy. You know, it's not really their job to be thinking about what's coming up next or what might be coming up next and sort of creating plans around that. That's really what you should be doing. And I feel like if you can spend more time getting the right people around you to fill in like all of the really important core work, and make sure they're really good at it as well, you know, that frees you up to be that sort of person who's got their head out of the turret and is sort of looking around and thinking about, you know, where we might go next or what might be coming around the corner, so that when it does happen, you know, you're not really spending too much time sort of squabbling with each other or panicking or whatever. It's all just kind of pretty clear because you've done the thinking on it, and it makes life for everyone a lot easier that way. So if that's advice that I had to give, that would be it, because every startup's different, you know. And I think that advice is pretty generally applicable though.
No, that's incredible advice. I mean, literally making sure it's your job to understand all the bad things that can happen so people can execute and you're ready for the future. That's incredible advice.
And not just bad things either. If thinking about the good things and how to exploit those opportunities is just as important. And I think that's also something people miss.
Simon, it's been incredible having you back on the podcast. And John, thank you so much for leading the conversation. And a shameless show here, but John and the Delphi team put out an incredible year-end infrastructure report webinar featuring Chainflip. So definitely check that out. But Simon, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been real fun.